Dean, I guess the first thing I would like to ask you about just deals with your father. Basically, can you just tell me a little bit about who he was and what were the circumstances which brought him to Boston University?
Well, my father was a boy of 14 years of age when he immigrated from Germany and with his family settled in southern Illinois, where he worked at various times on the farm or in coal mines. When he decided to go into the ministry, he had an opportunity to go to a German-speaking Methodist college, Central Wesleyan College in Warrenton, Missouri. The college had not only a liberal arts program, but also a theological course, which he took. The pious professors in the theological course were concerned that the new learning, that is, the higher criticism, the historical approach to the Bible, and all the rest, might confuse the students, so they taught it in a very defensive way. He naturally read the books of people like Wellhausen and Delitzsch, and people of that period. And when he graduated, he was, in a way, more persuaded by the books he had read than by the pious interpretations that had come from his faculty. When he started to preach in Somerville, Illinois, and later in Boody, Illinois, where I was born, he was really in a confused theological position, torn between the teachings he had received and the problems that presented him in the parish. Then he heard of Boston University, where they took the new higher learning constructively. On that basis, he said, to Boston, I must go. By that time, there were three of us children in the household, and my mother took the three of us in the fall of 1908 to her home in Red Wing, Minnesota. But he came on out to Boston, took a student parish, and began his studies. The following spring of 1909, the family joined him here, and we lived in North Stoughton, Massachusetts, where he was the minister. So he came here on a journey of adventure, seeking some way out of the tensions between conservative pietism and the modern world. He found that the solutions to that problem mostly in Burton Parker Bowen, although he was greatly helped and greatly admired by Albert C. Knudsen, who taught Old Testament at that time. Professor Sell was just beginning his teaching career here. And the professor of church history and systematic theology, Sheldon, also helped him a great deal. Now, Sheldon had been influenced by Bowen, so that there was a certain rapport there. Knudsen had been trained under Bowen, so that worked out very well in that connection.
Just as far as Fort Parker Bowen is concerned, I really get the impression, what you've told me before, that he was really sort of your father's mentor the time he was there.
That's true. My father, through all the period that I can recall as a boy growing up and in college, high school and college, he was always referring to Bowen, although he often referred to Knudsen. Knudsen was doing the conference circuit of pastor schools during most of this period, so my father kept contact with Knudsen. But it was Bowen primarily who made it all hang together coherently. Personalism became my father's central principle of coherence.
What were his impressions of Baum, both as an individual and as a professor? Did he ever talk to you about his teaching style and just how he was as an individual outside of the classroom?
Well, he didn't speak to us much about his life outside the classroom, but as a classroom person, he was a lecturer, and he drew easily on all of his resources in several languages, both German and French. He would move from English into these foreign language resources and back again very easily, to the discomfiture of a good many students. I can remember once Professor Brightman, who sat next to my father in class, taking notes, and my father was watching Brightman try to take down the German, and Brightman was very complimented when my father told him on one occasion, "Well, you've got it down right." Brightman at that time was finishing his seminary year and was getting ready as Jacob Sleeper Fellow to go to Germany. One of the other students at that time, a little bit older than Brightman, was later Professor Lostetter, and my father actually tutored Lostetter some in German in getting him ready for his study abroad. Now, getting back to Baum, Baum was a witty professor, and he had no hesitation in putting students down when he thought they were just talking foolishness. Now, you must remember that those were the days when people took the Bible very literally. And to have a philosophical, idealistic interpretation of God for people who had a very old-fashioned anthropomorphic view of God created certain difficulties. And Baum was very insistent on disabusing people of any anthropomorphic images of God.
Not the big one.
And one student got very persistent on this and quoted him the Bible about God walking around in the cool of the day. And Baum said, "Well, by that same method, God must have been a bird, because he says he hides us under his wing." And he didn't hesitate to move in pretty fast sometimes. On another occasion, he told a student that he ought to be arrested for his indecent mental exposure. Now, that can be viewed as pretty cruel, but Baum meant it, of course, in a kindly way, although he was a bit acerbic at times in the way he handled classes. But he inspired students. He was a charismatic teacher, and his English was lucid. He had, of course, been a journalist for the Independent magazine before he came to Boston, had a marvelous command of the English language. His books read with great fluency, and in our home, all of Baum's works were available.
I know there's a, with Baum, there's a very interesting story behind, around the time when Borden Parker Baum died, your father was in the process of working on his dissertation, and could you tell that story?
Well, my father was one of a few students who had a German background and who was able to read the German sources well. In several of his courses, not just with Baum, where German higher criticism books were used, or at least referred to, he would occasionally translate a chapter for the professors, and so that they would have it available. Bao liked the German language. He had himself been in Germany about 4 years in his student days. So my father had arranged with Baum to write his dissertation in German, and Baum thought he would like that very much. Well, of course, Baum died in the interim, and when my father had his dissertation finished, at least in the first draft, he submitted it, and by then, the person who succeeded Baum was not interested in reading a dissertation in German at Boston University, so they were at an impasse. One of Baum's most brilliant students was Bishop McConnell, and McConnell became bishop in 1912. I remember in that year, the people of Boston told my father if he would go to Minneapolis, where the General Conference was being held, and work out a satisfactory solution as to how the dissertation should be redone, whatever McConnell said would be satisfactory with the school. McConnell, of course, was not academically related to the university at that time, although he had had his PhD under Baum. So my father went to Minneapolis and worked out an arrangement with McConnell. It ended up that my father did have to write his dissertation in the English language. I remember that trip only in this respect, that as a five-year-old, I stayed in Red Wing, Minnesota with my grandparents for the period of the General Conference while my father went up to talk with Bishop McConnell about it. And thereafter, when he was completing his dissertation, which was completed in 1913, I remember early in the mornings in our home in Peoria by that time, that I would hear this old Hammond typewriter clicking away early in the morning while he was trying to get the dissertation worked on before the family got up. Those are some of the memories I have of that incident.
So he had done did he do a significant amount of the writing in German? And how did you find out that
yes. So that he had done. Yes. So he had a lot of work to do over and to rethink the whole thing in the English language. But it probably, in the long run, was good for my father because progressively, he was going to have to preach more in English than in German, as the German immigrants in the Methodist churches in this country were getting naturalized and acclimated, acculturated to the American scene. So it was probably a good thing in the long run, although he was naturally disappointed, particularly since he felt no one equaled Baum, and to have lesser lights turn him down, I think hurt his pride a little bit.
Getting back to some of the other professors besides Baum, when we talked before, you mentioned a professor of Shakespeare by the name of Carlton Black.
Yes. Well, Black was a professor in the College of Liberal Arts who was much of a master in English literature, particularly in Shakespeare. I would presume that what Black had as a special resource was an interest in the, what we would today call the spiritual values in Greek world literature, so that the great themes of life that were being wrestled with by Shakespeare were lifted up with special power and illumination. And Black would read a good many of the scenes in Shakespeare that had to do with these great themes. So that, they made a great impression, my father. He quoted Shakespeare a great deal in his sermons when he was preaching in English. I think the Shakespeare had another function in my father's development as well. My mother encouraged him to read Shakespeare aloud in English to improve his pronunciation of the English language, so that he got a bit into the cadence of Shakespearean phrases and style in the process of doing that. So Black made a tremendous contribution to him.
How about somebody like Knudsen, who had just, I think, came on the faculty around 1908?
Yes.
As a matter of fact.
My father was very much taken with this young professor who could make the Old Testament prophets walk in a living way. And my friendship, his friendship with Knudsen, continued very intensely, I think, in various annual conferences where Knudsen would come to speak, and in certain pastor schools. My father had practically all of Knudsen's works also in the library, as he came up. So I would say my father was profoundly influenced by Knudsen. The knowledge of the Old Testament prophets, particularly, which my father followed, would have been Knudsen's interpretation of the Old Testament prophets. Also, the notion, very popular at that time, of the progressive revelation was one that my father also appropriated from Knudsen.
How about George Croft Saddle?
He didn't speak much of Saddle. I think he had more work with Henry Sheldon than he did with Saddle. In his library, I remember there being both the historical works of Sheldon and his History of Christian Doctrine. One of the things that I think drew my father to the Boston professors a great deal was that so many of them had a year or two of work in Germany. And this put them on a language wavelength that was very appealing, and which established a rapport on that ground, as well as the congeniality of their ideas. But of Sal, I don't remember my father talking. I had Sal later as a professor, and I would not want to project back into the early days, but I remember a Sal in my own student days.
Mm-hmm. Just sort of a general question about the time when your father was there. Did he ever talk to you at all about the nature of student life? Now, I know he was in a position where he probably wasn't around the school as much. I know you mentioned he had a student pastorate.
My father didn't discuss student life, and I think for the reason that you have mentioned, he had to hurry back to North Stoughton and take care of the family there and the three small boys who were up there. He speaks only with fond references, however, to Old 72, as they called it. And he had a number of very good personal friends. A man named Kessler, well, and he mentions others. It happens also that he was very much attached to Saunders Wilkins, who was the black janitor or superintendent, whom all the students fondly appreciated. Saunders Wilkins was still around when I was a student 20 years later, and I can well understand why they appreciated him and why he was attracted to the students. Father refers to their chapel services, which were held in what in my day was known as the Richards Room. You see, the old school building up there had been a mansion, which was a little bit out of line with the essentially Georgian type of buildings up and down Mount Vernon Street. And in the first decade of this century, 72 Mount Vernon Street didn't yet have attached to it a chapel and classrooms and other things on Chestnut Street. Everything had to be accomplished in the main building, which had a number of features which Professor Cameron has well described in his history of the school. A well-appointed parlor, some gorgeous winding staircases, a very handsome small library of mahogany, a number of classrooms, and a central large room that connected the two halves of the building, which served as chapel and in my day served as a common social room for students.
Now I know that when you're, this is probably a good time to talk a little bit about 72, more about 72 Mount Vernon Street. I know that the chapel was built around 1915, I think probably after your father had left.
Right.
But was that right in the rear, on the first floor?
The new chapel, which was known as Robinson Chapel, given by Roswell R. Robinson, was just to the rear, yes. The chapel would have been at the first floor level. Then, because of Beacon Hill and of the incline on Chestnut Street, you had two floors below the chapel. The floor immediately below the chapel had classrooms. And the floor immediately below those classrooms was a gymnasium for students. So that from the outside, the appearance was one of considerable height, although from the street level of coming in on Mount Vernon Street, but went directly into the chapel.
How did the housing situation work at 72 Mount Vernon? And again, this is sort of, I guess, reflecting more on the time when you were there. I don't know how much it would have changed from, say, 1910 to 1927. But I know a certain number of students lived right at 72, and I guess between 1910 and 1927, certain buildings were acquired.
Well, when the In 72, Mount Vernon Street was acquired and renovated for a school building in 1886. It seems to be a very elegant and marvelous place. The student body in those days was small. I think only 80 or 90 students altogether. I'm talking about 1886. Then there was a large influx of students, and the school made rapid development. An additional floor was added onto 72 and 70, which made it a fine five-story building. But even that wasn't sufficient. Property was acquired at number 2 Lewisburg Square. Burney Hall was located there. Then over on Cedar Street and Revere Street, Beebe Hall, also named for one of the deans, as Burney Hall had been, was acquired. And much later, although that is after I left the school, but before I became dean, they acquired a property on Mount Vernon Street itself, known as Latimer Hall. Around the corner from the School of Theology on Willow Street was a property which the School of Religious Education acquired and which they used for dormitory. It was a place where Dean Marlatt, my predecessor, lived. It was known as the Hermitage. So most of the students, but all of them in single accommodations, no married student accommodations, lived in and around the school. And quite a few of them commuted from their parishes. So you had a design of student life that went something like this. There was no real refectory at the School of Theology. So students had to take their meals out. Most of the students, and most of them, of course, were male students, worked in restaurants in downtown Boston from 12 o'clock till 2. So the curriculum schedule was adapted to this work program. Our morning classes ended at 11:40, and that gave us time to scurry across the Boston Common to one or more of a dozen or more restaurants where students work till 2. The afternoon bank of classes began at 2:20. So that's the first image to have, that the curriculum of the school, as far as the main courses were concerned, the required courses were concerned, were scheduled around the work needs of the students. Then I think you should have the image that in those years there were hardly any Monday classes at all, and hardly no Friday afternoon classes. In fact, even Friday morning classes were sparse. So it had an effect, a very intense three-day curriculum with Friday, a day when students were taking off for their parishes, and Monday when they were returning. Now this was particularly a situation for the married students. There weren't the same numbers as now, and the percentage was low, but still, married students had hardly any place to live except to take a student parish. There were some who lived out in Boston, and I could detail some of the places where they lived if that is of interest.
Well, you're leading into an area I would really like to get back into, and that specifically is your father's involvement with his student parish.
All right.
What kind of a...
North Stoughton is a little crossroad about 2 miles north of the village of Stoughton. And there was a small Methodist church there. He had minimal responsibilities during the week. Most of the work needed to be done on weekends. The families of the parish took very vital interest in my parents and in us children. When I came back to the school in 1927, 20 years after my father had been there roughly 20 years, some of the people who had been my babysitters were by then the board members and the supporters of the church in a major way. Well, from the kinds of comments that they would make about my mother and how much they loved her, and their appreciation for my father, whom they always described as a person with a great deal of dignity and earnestness, and the way they received me indicated that their relationship with the parish was very close and very rich. Some of the people took great interest in introducing my parents to New England. We have old family pictures of friends who took them down to Plymouth Rock and other sites in the area. And my parents always did speak with great affection about the people in North Stoughton and their relationships to them. So they felt that they had been taken in a marvelous way.
This is sort of another general question along the same lines. You've sort of talked about it a little bit. But from his total experience in Boston, both the student pastorate and his experience in the classroom, what do you think, what things did your father take from Boston University back into his career, back into his ministry?
Well, I would say it was nothing short of a revolution in his life. I think he looks at it as a kind of a spiritual and intellectual salvation, which he never looked at life the same way again, either at the scriptures or at philosophy or at science or any of the problems that he had to deal with. If it weren't too intimate a term, I would say that he had experienced a kind of conversion. Certainly a revelation. He didn't need to experience a conversion in terms of loyalty to Christ or faith in Christ, but a whole new way of interpreting the scriptural message, the gospel message, and having something that he could share with people with confidence. I think he felt when he left Boston and throughout his career that when he spoke, when he preached the personalistic interpretation of the Bible, that he was speaking the truth. I think he had confidence that he had found truth, something unshakable, and in which he was thoroughly grounded. In that sense, there was an eternal gratitude in his spiritual and intellectual life to what Boston had done for him.
You mentioned, too, that there were certain classmates that he stayed particularly close with after he left.
Yes, he... among the people that he remembered with a great deal of affection and appreciation were Edgar S. Bracklin, Lostetter, Kessler. Those are the ones that I...
Did he and Brightman ever carry on any kind of correspondence?
I don't think that they continued. My father would buy Brightman's books when Brightman began to publish, had them in his library. But I think in the interim, until I came back as a student in those 20 years, they had not had very much contact. Mm-hmm. And I think Bracklin himself was surprised to meet me, because it seemed that a wide number of years had elapsed since he had seen my father, and Bracklin saw me show up at the beginning of the school year 1927. Knudsen he kept closer to, because Knudsen circulated among the conferences a great deal.
Now, did your father spend his entire active ministry in the parish?
Yes, his whole ministry, 50 years from the time of his ordination, which was before he came to Boston, was spent in the parish ministry in Illinois and Iowa and Wisconsin. We lived in Peoria, Illinois, immediately after his Boston years, for 4 years, and that would have covered part of the First World War. Then we moved to a small town in out in the country, a rural town, San Jose, Illinois, where we lived 5 or 6 years during the most of the war and immediately thereafter. Then he moved to Burlington, Iowa, which was a railroad town and a commercial center on the Mississippi River, where we were 4 years. Now his career in Burlington ended in the same year that the German-speaking conference, the St. Louis German Conference, merged with the English-speaking conference that were contiguous to it. Mm-hmm. And that naturally brought that era of his life to an end. Then he served for a year in Illinois again, at Minunk, Illinois, which was in the area of the strip mining of coal. And at the end of that year, was asked to go to Kenosha, Wisconsin to resume preaching in both German and English. Places like Burlington had been quite acculturated already, so that he did not do a lot of preaching in German in Burlington. It would be usually the prayer meetings, funerals, and the visiting of older people in their homes. But in Kenosha, a whole new era of his ministry began, because there had been a large influx of German people into Wisconsin after the First World War. I don't know whether you want me to elaborate on this or not.
A little bit more.
All right. Well, a typical Sunday in Kenosha would have had the following schedule. Keeping in mind that there were many second and third generation German people there, but also many first generation people, both young and old. Sunday morning at 9 o'clock, he would have preached in English. At 10:30, at what was regarded as the main service, he would have preached in German. While the English-speaking service was going on, a German Sunday school was taking place. And while the German service was going on, an English-speaking Sunday school was going on. This meant, of course, that there were choirs that used primarily the English language, and there would have been choirs that used the German language. On a Sunday evening, there would have been concurrent English and German-speaking Epithleges, as they were called at that time. The evening service was an English service. So you can see that my father was very busy on Sunday with three preaching services. During the week, there would have been only one prayer meeting, but it was conducted in both German and English. The church there had an Americanization program working. There were naturalization classes, training in people in citizenship, and helping these German immigrants to get acquainted with the industrial life of Kenosha. Kenosha can be identified today as being one of the homes of the American motors. In those days, Nash Motors, and I was living there about the time my father went there.
Did your father experience a rough time during the period of all the anti-German American feeling that was prevalent in this country before World War I?
Yes, during the First World War, where this kind of feeling was strong, would have been in San Jose, a small town of 500 people. It had only two churches. One was an English-speaking Methodist church, and one was the German-speaking Methodist church. Our German church was stronger than the English-speaking church. And there were a lot of German farmers who had done well and had invested rather heavily in Liberty Bonds. But anything German was an occasion for hatred and for prejudice during the First World War. And if you used the German language, this was a sign in the minds of some people that you weren't loyal. Hyphenated Americans were often hated, German American being an example. Well, the situation in San Jose got to a point where they painted the cornerstone of the church yellow. They threatened to bomb my father and so forth. On the school grounds, we children experienced a certain amount of this animosity. My older brother was called Big Kaiser, and my younger brother, Little Kaiser, myself, Middle Kaiser. So these epithets were very common during our years of growing up. At one point, my father asked the governor of Illinois to look into this situation and to help with it. The lieutenant governor came to this little town. The railroad that went through San Jose was only about three blocks from our house, the parsonage. And my parents were always very much amused to tell the story how the train came in just before lunch. And when these people in military regalia walked, there were three of them, walked down the street to go and interview my father as to what was really going on in town. They all thought that the...
Okay, you mentioned that they thought they were coming for the preacher.
Coming to get the preacher. And, of course, nothing happened. And my mother used to say, well, a lot of people burned their lunch waiting on their front porches to see the German preacher come down the street. Well, Secret Service people serving the governor and serving law and order kept their eye on the community during the rest of the war. Nothing too untoward happened. The irony of the situation was, in part, that since my father was the most educated person in the town with a PhD, a lot of the people who had to make out registration forms came to him for him to help them make out the forms for going into the service. So it had its humorous side as well as its serious side. In the congregation, there were people who were very much taken with the biblical numerology. And they were always speculating as to what the numbers in the book of Revelation meant with respect to the war and the catastrophes. Every war brings this on, and somebody goes through this exercise. But I can remember as a boy on one or two occasions where a group of people came to the parsonage and wanted to know what my dad thought about whether the beast was Kaiser Bill in Germany or somebody else.
Dean, I guess I just, as a wrap-up for today's session, I wanted to kind of pull us back into school theology for a few wrap-up questions. And I guess this one, just sort of a, once again, another very general question. You were probably 3 years old, when 3.5 years old, when you left BU. Yeah. Do you have any kind of recollections at all of Boston University or any stories that...
No, I do not have any first-hand recollections. I think I remember only what I take to be apocryphal ones. The one apocryphal story is that my father brought us children into the school on one occasion and took us up to the dean's office, and my father had me sit on the dean's lap.
Now, this would have been Marcus Buell.
It would have had to be Marcus Buell, I think, yes. But whether that actually happened, I'm not at all sure.
So you were supposedly sitting in the dean's
chair.
That's
right.
Just as far to set the tone maybe for our next session, when you made the decision to go to theological medical school, and you decided you were on your way to Boston University School of Theology. What were your goals? Were you thinking in terms of going into parish ministry, or were you looking at that point already towards a career in education?
Well, I was a student at Knox College at the time, Knox being an independent college in Illinois. I had a major in American history and was minoring in literature, mostly English literature, although some comparative literature. I was very much interested in history and was also thinking about pursuing graduate studies in the field of philosophy. I had given consideration to a number of major institutions in the Midwest where I could pursue graduate studies, but I was also thinking that perhaps the ministry would be it, but I think I was drawn in my imagination more to teaching than to ministry. However, as a very existential fact, the last 2 years of my college, I had as a student pastor. Strange as it would seem today, at 18 years of age, I was in charge of a two-point circuit in central Illinois, at one church about 10 miles from Galesburg and one 4 miles from that place, just a church in the open country. And I would, of course, have to walk from the town of Gilson, which had 147 members, out to this place out in the country, which had only a church and a social hall. There was no store or anything connected with it. Well, having preached for 2 years as in many ways a meal ticket for my getting through college, and having apparently done some such satisfactorily, I naturally had the ministry in mind. Now, I was really hesitant about a theological seminary. The reason was not because of anything that had ever happened at home. I had met an awful lot of ministers in the Midwest, both in our Methodist conference and conservative rural ministers at the time when I was in this two-point circuit, who had gone to places like Moody Bible Institute, who just seemed theologically and intellectually obnoxious to me, to be perfectly frank about it. And I therefore had an image that if I went to a theological school, I might be put into a kind of prefab intellectual framework, which I was then expected to follow from there on. So I was a little reluctant. I had, however, some good talks with my father about it, and I admired him very much and appreciated him. He had none of these traits himself, but then I always regarded him as an exception. Well, he said, well, why don't you give Boston a try, and if after a year you don't like it, you can always go somewhere else. And my older brother, Herman, was also a history major. We graduated at the same time. Became a graduate student at the University of Minnesota in the field of history. So I felt, yes, there was a way out if I didn't finally want to do a theological course and become ordained. I could go into teaching. But when I came to theological school, I really had a double option. Yes, I would not object to ministry. I felt drawn to it. At the same time, my real preference, my real sense of calling was to become a teacher of some kind. And if possible, to become a teacher of philosophy. And this, I think, I was influenced by my father's experience with Gordon Parker Brown. Mm-hmm.
Dean, one final question. We've hinted on this once again a little bit earlier on, but how do you think the school changed from the time that your father left, circa 1910, to when you arrived in the fall of 1927 to begin your studies?
Well, it undoubtedly grew in faculty size. I don't believe that it changed in perspective. Excuse me, if anything, it became more solidified in the personalist viewpoint. Because when I arrived in 1927, there were many students of Baum and many graduates of the school who were here. Let me just name some of them. Brightman and Strickland in psychology of religion, and Marlatt and Sell and Lostutter and Wildman and Knudsen. And there were even others. In other words, the school was pretty solidly in the control of people who had been trained in the era in which my father had been a student, and the personalist perspective of Baum dominated. Now, there were variations among the personalists. I don't want to say that it was at all intellectual cloning, if you want to put it that way. Strickland in psychology was very open to world religions, to the new trends in pastoral care, to the dynamic psychology of Freud and Jung and all that. Sal was in rebellion against Brightman. Sal was taking a very pragmatic William James approach to things, so different from what he thought Brightman was doing. Lostutter was essentially non-philosophical, was eager to give the students a Jesus they could preach, and we all appreciated that. Marlatt had come under the influence of Brightman a good deal, although Marlatt was interested in spiritual values in world literature, had a year at Oxford, and so forth. So that while they had a common core of reference, these were very brilliant men with great varieties of interest, so that I never felt myself confined in my experience. It was a wonderful experience, in fact.
Well, Dean, we'll have a chance to pursue this a little bit more in our next session, and we'll talk more about the history of the school when you were there and some of the personalities and events that took place when you were a student at BU.
All right, I'll be glad to do it.